is Thursday, June 27th, 2019. Yes, Arnie is back in the saddle again. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And, of course, sitting in for Ken Barnes, who, by the way, is down in Homestead and been hanging out with Elizabeth Warren in Florida, are my two fabulous other producers. We have Dave Scott sitting in the big chair, and we have Stephanie sitting in the other chair, and Stephanie Collins. So I want to thank both of them for showing up, since Ken is doing his thing on immigration policy down in Florida, and we're really glad that he's protesting and getting the candidates to come. And apparently a number of them actually did go down to Homestead, which is fabulous. So let me just apologize. Well, no, I'm going to apologize. So yesterday we had some old shows. Please understand they were from like January, but they were good content. That's important. And then, of course, on Monday and Tuesday, we had Bill Curry, an amazing, amazing interview about impeachment and about the upcoming debates, which last night was the first night. And then we had Eric Holder, and he was in studio, and you've heard me apologize profusely about the fact that I did not ask him the most important question: why didn't you send to jail any of those banksters as a result of the 2008 economic meltdown? Arnie, you are a coward. I apologize. Anyway, but what we talked about with Eric Holder is really important, because Eric Holder came into my studio to talk about what? Redistricting, everyone. Redistricting. And he was talking about the fact that we want to make sure that districts look more like the communities in which they live, that we don't have partisan gerrymandering. And of course, we were hoping that the court would get rid of partisan gerrymandering. But as Scott Braddock has just pointed out in a 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court today, everyone, released this decision. In a 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court takes the federal courts out of the equation, right as, and this is his tweet from a Texas perspective, right as Texas Democrats had hoped to take the Texas House in 2020, still doable, but with a goal of forcing a federal court fight on congressional maps after the 2021 session. What he's referring to is the courts have now validated partisan gerrymandering. 5-4. Partisan gerrymandering. I mean, how depressing is that, everyone? It's just, ugh, oh my God. Anyway, you know what partisan gerrymandering means, everyone? You know what gerrymandering means? It means politicians get to pick their voters. Can I repeat this? Politicians get to pick their voters. This decision sucks. And before I grab, so let me explain to you what's happening today. Historically, we interview Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas. We usually interview him on Thursday morning, so then we can air it on Friday. But in light of the fact that there is another debate tonight, we decided that what we had to do is we had to grab Scott and bring Scott on so that he could come on at noon today, because we wanted to cover the debate after the debates tomorrow, and we couldn't have a show in the can. So live and in person, this is like unbelievable, Scott. You are not live to tape, you are live to air. Scott Braddock is now joining us, and that decision on gerrymandering is, you're absolutely right, this is freaking huge. So you may want to weigh in on that, especially in light of the fact that places like, you know, Georgia and Texas, I mean, wherever Republicans are is where partisan gerrymandering is. Democrats want to be fair now. They probably weren't fair in the past, but suddenly they've come to Jesus on this. But this is terrible unless Democrats control more state legislators. Anyway, welcome to the program, Mr. Braddock. How are you?
Well, Arnie, it all comes back to Texas, as always. We pioneered all of this here. Go back to the 2002 elections when Republicans used laundered cash, allegedly secret money, to build a majority in the Texas House of Representatives. In 2001, that was the redistricting year, of course, because 2000 is when the census was done, and then the maps are drawn the following year. Coming up, we do that again, right, in 2021. But in 2002, there was a wholesale effort to break the ban on corporate donations to political candidates by the Republican Party, engineered by the now former Speaker of the Texas House, Tom Craddock, and U.S. Majority Leader Tom DeLay, who, of course, was later indicted, convicted, and then his conviction was thrown out over all of this years later. All of this always plays out, of course, over a full decade, and is a full employment act for attorneys who do this kind of work. So in 2003... And this is how egregious it all was, Arnie.
This is, I want everyone to hear this. This is an important history lesson to understand the consequences of what the Supreme Court just did. Keep going.
In 2001, the districts were drawn by the Democratic legislature. And then in 2003, when the Republicans took over, it was thought that the redistricting was already done, but the Republicans just said, no, we're in charge now, so we're going to redraw the district.
Oh.
So they did a mid-decade redistricting simply because they held the gavels at that point.
Right, a never-ending story.
Never-ending story. This, of course, was when you had the big quorum break where Texas Democrats actually left the state deny a quorum so that this could not happen like what happened in Oregon or is unfolding in Oregon right now over this climate change bill.
Right.
It was sort of flashbacks for us in Texas. About 20 years now since, you've had another redistricting, in 2011. And of course, what happens with this stuff, Arnie, is when they redraw the maps and they're optimized for Republican advantage, those maps, as long as they basically hold up in court, those become the baseline for what happens with the maps going forward. So over the next two decades, you have what was sort of the fruit of this tree from 2002, 2003. And think about this fact, Arnie.
Okay.
What did I say?
Enlighten me.
Hidden money was used. Secret money was used to win the elections. Then they did extreme partisan gerrymandering in this state. And in the years since, what has happened at the United States Supreme Court? Hidden money is now okay, right? Citizens United. And today, according to this 5-4 decision, this is why these elections are so important, Arnie.
Oh,
we're putting those justices on the Supreme Court.
Oh, no.
5-4 decision says that extreme partisan gerrymandering is okay. And not only is it okay, but that the courts don't have any say in it, right? That's what the ruling says. This is from the Chief Justice Roberts, John Roberts. He said that excessive partisanship in redistricting leads to results that reasonably seem unjust. But that does not mean that the solution lies with the federal judiciary. Instead, the Supreme Court concludes that partisan gerrymandering claims present political questions beyond the reach of federal courts. So even if there's extreme gerrymandering in your state, can't sue over that. Now, we should make something very clear, though.
Okay.
So in Texas, when the maps have been challenged in court, they've been challenged on the basis of racial discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And courts have said over and over again that that is illegal. And this ruling does not undo that. This is from the Texas House Democratic Caucus Chairman just a few minutes ago. Chris Turner is a Democrat from Arlington, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, despite the decision from the Supreme Court, quote, redistricting that results in racially discriminatory maps, as has happened in Texas many times, remains illegal. So that means for these cases going forward, you can't have Democrats saying that Republicans are setting up a map that's too Republican and vice versa. But you can have court challenges that still say that these maps are drawn in a way that dilutes minority voting strength. And what that means is that if you have an area that's primarily Latino, that those folks in that area should have the opportunity to elect candidates that represent their interests.
Well, and let's just say something outright. As the Republican Party sees its numbers dwindling because the demographics are changing, what we're seeing is that it's a white party. It's a white male party, probably even more than anything else. So in a bizarre way, they may have won this war, but they're not going to win in the end because the country is changing. The demographics are changing. They have no message for Latinos. They have no message for blacks. They have no message for women. And they're going to face those consequences. We can call it a civil rights issue. We can say this is race-based. But in the end, it's going to be harder and harder for them to cling to power because what they have left is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And you're absolutely right. We may not be able to prove that it's partisan gerrymandering. We are going to be able to prove that it's race-based gerrymandering. Or, that's the sad commentary here. But at the same time, partisan gerrymandering, as you even heard, you mentioned Justice Roberts. He even says it's bad. It doesn't look good. But it's just not unconstitutional.
Sure.
So his fig leaf is, this sucks, but it's legal suck.
Well, and something being
God.
Unconstitutional and something being ridiculous are different. I would say that, to your point, in a lot of these cases when partisanship has come up, race and partisanship are often proxies
yes,
for each
thank
other.
You. Exactly. That's
depending
my point.
On,
exactly.
Depending my point. On, you know, what the fact pattern is. So we'll see what impact this has going forward. But, you know, those challenges that are based on race are still alive.
But, you know, I want to go back a little bit to your history because you talked about this illegal money that was used to create these things. And now that illegal money is legal because of Citizens United.
That's,
right. That's yep. What's so depressing about so much of what we see now that is corrupting the system is that because people have influence now, they can make what used to be criminal behavior legal behavior. I want people to hear this. It used to be criminal behavior. It used to be illegal. And you can influence the system and the outcome and flip what used to be illegal and make it legal. Does it make it right? No. Does it make it just? No. But it does make it legal, which gives Justice Roberts the ability to say, like he does, oh, but the Constitution says nothing about it, even though you know how horrific the consequences are. He's not looking at the consequences. He's looking at this piece of paper that never envisioned the kind of crap we're seeing.
Yeah, and let me add a layer to that, which is you can say that it's wrong and that it's not great, or you can say that it's right, but right and wrong and legal and illegal are completely different. Republicans, to their credit, have been so good at focusing on the fundamentals of the way the game works as far as power and how it's allocated. When it comes to, you know, how much campaign cash can be spent, they focus like a laser on that. When it comes to this redistricting question, focus like a laser on that. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that there's a complete meltdown about in this state, you know, nearly 20 years ago. And I would expect another one coming up in 2021. And the Democrats, this last legislative session in Texas, which, of course, we talked about, you know, throughout the last 6 months or so here on the show, we're working so hard to get along with Republicans, and Republicans working to get along with them, basically taking arguments off the table for firing Republican leadership. You had Democrats in this state praising the new Speaker, Dennis Bonin, the Republican from the Houston area, as the right man for this moment in history. And all that's a quote from a Democrat. Well, so then in the next election, Arnie, what's the argument to voters to fire him as Speaker? I don't know, but guess what? In 2021, I think if Republicans retain control of the Texas House, it might look a lot like it did here in 2003 when they run roughshod over the Democrats, because guess what? That's the argument that's about power and who gets to keep it for the next 10 years.
I'm going to go back to your history lesson, because what you said was this was a never-ending redistricting. So even though they lost, the Democrats had won, and then they lost the control of the legislature, they changed the districts because there were new people in power. Well, in the end, Republicans need to remember that. They sucked by doing that. You know, but they also gave the Democrats a roadmap, because if the Republicans win in 2020 and it turns out that they do this incredible gerrymandering, then people can be so this is the dilemma. You and I both know it. The dilemma is it can make people sort of rise up. But what they've done by creating the gerrymandering is that it becomes even harder for Democrats to then sort of retake the legislature. But I'm telling you, they're giving people an impetus to suddenly realize that process matters. And what the Republicans are doing by process is not only are they destroying anything in the way of fairness, but now you will know that outcomes will reflect an unfair system that they have created. Yeah. Oh my God, it's just so horrific.
It's pretty remarkable, and I have to tell you that I can't imagine if Republicans, you know, are able to oversee redistricting in Texas in 2021, and then, you know, somehow in the next cycle the Democrats are able to take the majority in the Texas House come 2023.
Yeah.
I can't imagine it would be a Democratic Party that I am completely unfamiliar with that would then try to do its own redistricting after that.
I know.
You know, in the next 2 years. I mean, it could happen, as you said.
I understand,
but it's always a permissive thing, Arnie. It's like it's been the tradition. It's been what we do do the redistricting after the census.
But then the
Republicans come in and they say
and they don't get
a great argument. And by the way, nobody makes a great argument against them. They come in and they say, well, but can't we just do it again in 2003?
Exactly. No, it's just it is so depressing what you're telling me. So the problem is, so because you have respect for the way the institution should be run, you're screwed, because these guys have no respect for anything. Rules have no meaning because they can be broken, you know, or they can be amended, or, you know, now we're in power, forget what we did 2 years ago, because we're not going to respect that decision. We had Eric Holder in studio with us for an hour. He started by talking about redistricting, about the fairness, and about partisan gerrymandering and all this stuff, and how we want a fair system and an independent commission to make these decisions. Why is it one side that's talking about this? And what I said to Eric, which is absolutely true, Republicans ultimately want a fair redistricting, because it may be the only thing that saves them from their future. Because their future is, if we're going to see a changing demographic and we're going to see a browning of America, they are screwed. And if they're in an unfair system that they want to perpetuate, they are going to lose dramatic power. A fair system actually allows them access to power. So in a bizarre way, yeah, a fair redistricting saves the Republican Party, whether they know it or not.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, redistricting is basically building a fortress,
yes,
is the way I describe it. You set up these districts in such a way that there are some impenetrable precincts,
yes,
for certain folks in certain areas. Over the last 10 years, the sort of perfect storm that has come together for Republicans in Texas is two things. One is the degradation of the districts. They degrade, mm-hmm, over the 10 years, every cycle, because there are changes in basically neighborhoods change, right?
People
are born, people die,
right,
and
exactly,
all of that. And so when you have such explosive growth, particularly in the Texas suburbs, and I've started to think of it this way, Arnie, in the rest of the country, the approval rating for the president hovers around 40%.
Mm-hmm.
He's anywhere between 35 and 43, something like that. So he's, mm-hmm, around 40%.
Mm-hmm.
And people from the rest of the country, by the thousands, move to the Texas suburbs every day. 1,200 people move to Texas every day. So if those people are moving from all those other places, and those districts are completely different from what they were when they were originally drawn 10 years ago, you now have what has come together, a confluence of events, with,
right,
President Trump at the top of the ticket in 2020, and districts that don't look anything like they did when they were drawn 10 years ago.
Right.
This is the opening for the Democrats, and,
right,
in some ways, the Supreme Court ruling today kind of pulls the rug out from under them, or sort of like Lucy with the football, pulls the football, because what they were on track to do was take advantage of that perfect storm I'm talking about and then take the gavels in the Texas House come 2021. That may still happen. And if there is a battle over what these districts are going to look like for the next 10 years, it will be altered by the fact that Democrats were able to win races, but the fact that they don't have the same kind of redress in the courts is certainly
a
game changer.
And again, we'll have to move on to another topic, but I just want to remind everyone, the best time to change the dynamic is in the last 2 years of just before the census, because as you point out, that's when the districts are the weakest. That's when all that sort of clever gerrymandering is at its weakest. And while they may have given someone a 6% edge or a 5% edge, they may only have a 1 or 2% edge by the end of the decade. And that's something that if you bring more voters in and you inspire more voters, you can actually win. And if there's a time for people in Texas to be running, for people to be voting, for people to be exercising the franchise, God, please do it now. This is the time, because that's when change can happen. Unbelievable. All right, darling. So debate last night, the big debate last night was not only the rise of Castro, which everyone says he was the winner of last night, but it's what Castro did to Beto. Were you surprised by that? So hold my hand and explain to me, because I thought that, I always see Julian Castro as kind of more like wallpaper. He seems to be kind of quiet and nice and, whatever. But he was fiery last night, and more than fiery, he actually pulled the weapons out and he used it on a fellow Texan, Beto. This was somewhat, it took a lot of people's breath away, because they were like, what are you doing? I understand why he did it. He was effective in it, but it was an interesting move.
Well, to have the two Texans who are running for president on the same stage, not good for Beto O'Rourke at all. There is a big fight here going on to be the Texas candidate,
right?
Because when you go into that sort of super Tuesday, where California and Texas are voting at the same time, the same day next year, so many delegates are up for grabs. You have seen Kamala Harris, who's going to be on stage tonight, try to make some incursions in Texas territory. She was campaigning in Dallas County and Harris County, where Houston is, very delegate-rich areas, and making a play for the superdelegates as well. And look, Castro understands that his path to power here, his path to more relevance, is blocked primarily by the other Texan in the race.
Mm-hmm.
So he took aim at him. And Beto did not do well. I mean, I would say it this way. He didn't really cast a shadow. The only thing anybody remembers is that he got attacked by Castro.
Exactly.
And
how perfect
and that
is
he,
that?
And that, and that he didn't answer one of the questions in English or in Spanish when he attempted it, in both languages, about what the top marginal tax rate ought to be.
Right.
So Castro broke out the big guns for a reason. I would also say it's interesting that he is doubling down on what is his signature issue, which is immigration and border security.
This is awful.
And for a reason. I mean, he speaks from the gut on that issue because it's the story of his life.
Right.
You know, I mean, his family is a family of immigrants who came to San Antonio, where he became the mayor, where he later, of course, you know, here in the United States, became the HUD secretary and all of that. And him being the only Latino in the race is a huge deal. And so he needed that breakout moment. And he's, you know, one of those candidates who's been lagging in the polls in a bad way. He's one of those one percenters. And O'Rourke, for whatever reason, has still, you know, been up around 3 or 4% some of those polls. Of course, he was higher than that previously, but he's fallen back down. So the long knives came out. Arnie?
Well, let me just say something, and this is awful, but let's say there had been a huge strike at some plant. That would have been a great thing for Tim Ryan. Let's say that there was some sort of climate calamity. That would have been a great thing for Jay Inslee. Sadly,
yeah.
What really was the backdrop for Julian was the death of that father and that young girl. So we knew we were going to be talking about immigration.
That's right.
We were going to be talking about homestead and detention centers or concentration camps, whatever you want to call it. That was clearly going to happen. But that event to have happened, to be shown over and over again and talked about it was just so horrific. And to see the story in the Washington Post of what the family looked like before they made the trip. I mean, it's heartbreaking on so many levels. And that meant that he was given an opening because no matter what was going to happen, obviously the immigration question was going to be discussed. No question, but he had an emotional backdrop that really gave rise to his signature issue.
Well, let me tell you, this is migration season. So exactly 1 year ago, what was happening, Arnie, the initial big anger, backlash over the family separations on the border. It was the backdrop for the Texas Democratic Party's state convention.
Right.
And Democrats here are very angry about that, as a lot of folks were angry about it around the country. Same thing happening right now. This is summer. This is migration season. So
exactly.
If you look at 2014, years ago, when Rick Perry deployed National Guard troops to the border, 1,000 of them, it's the same exact headline as last week when Governor Abbott sent 1,000 National Guard troops to the border. Humanitarian crisis. This is terrible. This needs to be dealt with. This time of year is when that's going to be the backdrop. So think forward to next year. This time, and you'll be looking at the same backdrop. Now, who is that good for? It seems right now that it's good for the Democrats. There's so much backlash to the president, and he has to be on defense about all this and the way his administration's handling it. And if he's still handling it the same way, it'll be the same context in which this debate is happening next year at the same time.
Yeah, I tweeted something out the other day because I kept thinking, if the Russians can manipulate the election and get Donald Trump, could someone be manipulating what's going on in El Salvador and Guatemala? And is this one of the reasons why we see this enormous spike? Because let me tell you what the enormous spike is good for.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the enormous spike is good for Donald Trump because he can say, oh, look at them. They're flooding over the border. The enormous spike is also good for what? For the private detention centers that are just making money hand over fist. So in a bizarre way, I wish I thought this was happening only because of the instability in El Salvador and Guatemala, which obviously helps. You know, it's definitely there. But I am now so suspicious, and you can thank Donald Trump for that, because what I see, I don't believe Donald Trump, because I know that outside influences can change the course of people's behavior. And guess what? It's in your benefit to have that happen. Sorry.
Since we're doing history lessons today, And as I said, all this happens at the exact same time every year. This is when it happens, in the summer. It was right around this exact same time. In fact, the date on the story I'm looking at from 2014 is July 23rd, so just about a month from now in that year. Why Rick Perry is sending the National Guard to the Texas border. Here's what's different, though, Arnie.
Yeah.
Here's something that did not happen in 2014, what is happening now.
Yep.
Governor Abbott last week sent troops to the border, 1,000 National Guard to back up the personnel who are already there.
Yeah.
They actually can't do anything. They don't have any enforcement authority. Here's what didn't happen in 2014. 3 days later, this Monday, Governor Abbott sent out a fundraising email saying, "I need your campaign contributions.
Ugh.
We're securing the border. I sent troops to the border." Rick Perry back in 2014 did not do that. I think that we have reached a new level of cynicism about all
this. And on that note, Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He is also known affectionately as the Voice of Texas. We adore him. No, it is not Friday. It is Thursday. But we're going to be talking about the debate tonight, tomorrow. Thank you so much for adjusting your schedule for us.
Absolutely. Thanks, Arnie.
All right, ciao. All right, everyone, a little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1905. That was the day over 200 socialists, anarchists, and Marxists representing over 40 organizations met at Brands Hall in Chicago to convene the founding of the Industrial Workers of the World. Representatives from groups like the Socialist Party, Socialist Labor Party, and Western Federation of Miners joined together for an 11-day convention to discuss the future of industrial unionism and revolutionary struggle. Those present included Big Bill Haywood, James Connolly, Daniel De Leon, Eugene V. Debs, Lucy Gonzalez Parsons, Mother Jones, and many more. They hoped to cohere an alternative to the politically conservative business unionism of the American Federation of Labor. They sought to build on the legacy of the Knights of Labor and their motto of "an injury to one is an injury to all." They were determined to build an industrial union that organized workers regardless of skill level. They also distinguished themselves by opening their doors to men and women, black, white, and all immigrant workers, including Asians. Big Bill Haywood opened the first day's morning session with the following remarks, saying, quote, "This is the Continental Congress of the Working Class. We are here to confederate the workers of this country into a working class movement that shall have as its purpose the emancipation of the working class from the slave bondage of capitalism. There is no organization that has for its purpose the same object as that for which you are called together today. The aims and objects of this organization should be to put the working class in possession of the economic power, the means of life, in control of the machinery of production and distribution without regard to capitalist masters." For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Arvin, California is in Kern County, one of the top oil-producing areas in the U.S. 5 years ago, a gas pipeline leak in Arvin forced dozens of residents from their homes for months.
Right there and then, community members said, this is a bigger problem, and we need to solve it.
Juan Flores with the Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment helped organize concerned residents. He says they campaigned to elect city leaders willing to stand up to the fossil fuel industry. Their efforts made a difference. Last year, the city passed regulations prohibiting new oil and gas wells within 300 feet of homes, schools, and other locations.
It might not seem like a lot, but when you come to Kern County, you see that literally behind a church or behind a clinic or behind a school, within 20 feet, there's an oil pump.
So he says creating the buffer zone was a victory and sets an example for other communities dealing with fossil fuel pollution.
They don't have to wait on their county. They do not have to wait on the state. Community members should feel that they have the power to truly change the negative impacts of pollution, that it's something that is winnable.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Lord, getting crazy out there. Taj Mahal. I love it, Dave Scott. Thank you so much. That was a fabulous choice. Dave is sitting in for Ken Barnes. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And Stephanie and Dave are sitting in the engineering seat. So actually, that's a great theme song. I think the Democrats should play that when they're talking about Donald Trump. Every time they mention the name, that should be the song that should come up. It would be hilarious during the convention, I think. I'm going to plan it. I'm going to produce it. So if it's Thursday, although we did have Scott Braddock at the first half, we are being joined by one of our all-time faves, known affectionately as Dr. Politics. Professor Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State is joining us. And last night, Stefan in Iowa is watching the debate. Arnie in New Hampshire is watching the debate. Of course, I'm not paying a lot of attention to all the emails he's sending me, which, by the way, were brilliant. But literally at the same time as you said, wow, Castro is doing really well, I'm saying out loud, wow, Castro is doing so well. So, you know, this is really interesting, Stefan. I rarely agree with Chris Cillizza a lot. I mean, we always say, but you sent me what he said. The CNN analyst, Chris Cillizza, says Castro, Warren, and Booker won. That's exactly what I said. Exactly what I said. And then he said, as for losers, O'Rourke was hard to watch. Klobuchar never really got started. And this is fabulous. And de Blasio would win the Olympic gold medal for, quote, interrupting as rudely as possible. He looked like such a New Yorker. Unbelievable. Welcome to the program, Stefan Schmidt.
It's always a pleasure to be on left-wing radio, Arnie.
Left-wing radio. Oh, stop it. Well, do you disagree with Cillizza?
I thought it was a pretty good analysis. Obviously, Elizabeth Warren, you know, she kind of had won before the debate began, frankly.
Yes, everyone knew that.
I mean, she had. Nobody contested that. In Iowa, the Des Moines Register, one of their major columnists, had this incredible, praiseworthy column saying that all that would need to happen last night was for Elizabeth Warren to consolidate her position as the front runner against Joe Biden eventually. And, you know, and so she did a great job doing what she has to do. So that's why our interest
wasn't everybody else.
To all of the others, right?
Exactly,
yeah.
Right. Exactly, yeah. Right. Well, let me here's a couple of things I saw. And I'm really glad we had Scott Braddock on for the first half because he sort of helped us explain the Beto, you know. And actually, it's even more than that. So there are two Texans running for president. Clearly, since Texas is such a voter-rich state, you really want to make sure that one of them leaves the stage before you actually get to vote in the primary. So this was really important, and Julian played that card brilliantly. I mean, yeah. Beto looked like a deer in headlights. Like, where is this coming from? How could you attack me? But he did this. But the other problem for Julian is that Kamala Harris, who is also running for president, who will be on the debate stage tonight, also understands that she wanted the California primary and the Texas primary on the same day. And she really sees Texas as a place she wants to cultivate. So in a lot of ways, who was really disappointed about how well Julian did last night was Kamala Harris, because I think she was hoping that both of them would sort of kind of, you know, fizzle during the debate stage. And instead, the worst thing for Kamala was that Julian was really, he was the winner of the night. Everyone said that. I mean, everyone said Warren did fabulously well, but there was no expectation other than that she would do well. So she didn't exceed expectation. But Julian did, and that's what last night was about.
It was, and it's because he seemed, in everything else he's done, he seemed very quiet. Mm-hmm. He seemed not very charismatic.
Exactly.
And last night what he did was he used his incredible expertise of immigration law and his passion for it to basically jump the shark there, you know, and suddenly, well, in any case, he was really good. I would say that Kamala Harris is probably pretty happy that someone else besides Elizabeth Warren is now suddenly looking interesting.
Yes,
because
the
risk for her is that, you know, that it's a woman, it's a progressive, and, well, Warren is going to get it. So that if Julian Castro can do well in Texas, that reduces Elizabeth Warren's ability, perhaps, to gather large numbers of delegates. So that's what I see going forward, is
how many Democrats can chip away, on the one hand, at Joe Biden, on the other hand, at Elizabeth Warren, and then bring other people into play and moving forward so, towards the convention next year.
All right, so, Stefan, refresh my recollection. Am I correct that didn't at one point Hillary Clinton think about Julian Castro as a possible VP pick?
She did.
So yes, she must be kicking herself in the butt. Because instead she picked a white guy from Virginia. I mean, it was like, and he wasn't very dynamic and he wasn't very exciting. I mean, at least what you saw with Julian is that Julian has actually learned on the job. He's always been a very smart guy. Everyone said, I've not yet seen him in a small setting, but they said he's informed, he's engaging, he's smart. They really liked him. And I had a hard time imagining that because I kind of see him the way you do, kind of that wallpaper Julian. Well, what the living room Julian was the guy that came on the stage. And that was what was so exciting, was that now I understand why people were saying, you know, he's impressive, Arnie. Pay attention to him. You saw impressive last night. What I saw last night is I saw the VP pick that he wasn't in 2016. He is definitely going to be the VP.
That's true. That's true. Yes. He would make a good pick.
Perfect. He'd be perfect.
I think for someone like Elizabeth Warren, if she dominates the field, I think, and it's the opposite of what Hillary Clinton did, which was Hillary Clinton.
She played it so damn safe.
She's not from Arkansas.
Oh,
and she's not from Illinois. Hillary Clinton is from New York.
No, Chicago.
And she picked someone just south of New York as her running mate. Oh. So there wasn't any appeal to the rest of the country by her VP pick. So, interesting dynamics.
No. We were watching the 10 people last night. We'll watch the 10 people tonight. And I kept seeing, which cabinet position are they? Who's the VP?
Right.
What's the cabinet position? It's kind of like I want the app so I can start like challenging people, saying, okay, pick your cabinet player. And that's really how I feel. It's kind of like, fantasy football, only we're going to call it, fantasy cabinet. And literally, but that's what was so exciting, though, about last night. Even the people that were kind of they didn't punch out. There was nothing that incredibly exciting. You did see areas of expertise where for a couple of seconds they could shine. And I think that was actually useful. But I also think you begin to realize that some of those people will not be available for the electorate in the next debate because they can't possibly continue. Or in this case, like Delaney, using his own money, at some point in time, his wife's going to call him up and say, stop. You can't. I mean, I know you're rich and successful, but we're not going to pardon the expression, pissing away our children's future by all this money you're spending on this race. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be fascinating. But I want to talk about one thing. And that is, everyone said, when was asked the question about Medicare for all. And the question that was asked was, who would get rid of private insurance? And I believe only two people on the stage did. And immediately, she didn't even think twice. I believe it was Bill de Blasio and Elizabeth Warren. She raised her hand. So can we talk a little bit about health insurance? Will you help me understand who likes health insurance?
I live in Iowa. Des Moines is the second largest insurance capital of the United States.
So from an employee perspective of an insurance company.
We have huge insurance companies, and a lot of them do health insurance.
It's
a big topic. And the question, of course, is, are you happy with your current health insurance coverage?
Right.
And, yes, I agree with you. A lot of people kvetch about it and complain about, they can't get their prescriptions filled quickly and for more than
one month, all of those things.
But on the other hand, most of the people that, when they're polled, and I think I sent you a poll from, I can't remember, one of the really reliable health insurance, companies, not a company, but a basically, what would you call it, a research group or whatever. I think it was.
Was it Kaiser Permanente?
54% of people are okay with the health insurance
Let me step back. So I want to talk about health insurance, not in the fact that it's okay. I want to talk to people about their deductibles. How many hate your deductibles? Raise your hand. I want to talk about how many people are contributing to their premiums. Please raise your hand. I want to know about people who love to make sure that they're always in network. Please raise their hand. I want to make sure that they have to call their insurance company before they can go see the dermatologist because they have to approve the dermatologist. So I'm going to walk them through what I'm saying. You know what we're just talking about, folks? We're not talking about healthcare. We're talking about suck insurance, because insurance insurance is not health care. And I think people need to start defining what people want. They don't want insurance. They want a doctor. They want to be able to afford their script. People go bankrupt even with health insurance. This is where I think Elizabeth Warren has a wonderful opportunity. It isn't about the fact that you want to ban insurance companies. You want to ban profit on illness. Bingo.
Yes, bingo. Yes. And you know, then the question is, again, back to what we've talked about before. The,
yep.
You know, is the devil you know better than the one you don't?
No.
You know, what is the replacement of the health insurance? I mean, this is the Gallup poll did a poll in 2018,
yep.
and 69% of Americans rated the coverage of their health insurance as excellent or good, and the rate of the coverage and the quality, 80% of them said that the health care they personally received is excellent or good.
Okay, so let me
you know, this is a problem what is the replacement? I mean,
I understand. No, let me just stop and say something. So here's the bad news, good news story. The bad news is, I'll use my father as an example. My father was a New York City school teacher. My father had the same job for 40 years. My father never knew what it was like not to be insured. Never, okay? And he had good insurance because he was in a union. Here's his daughter. His daughter has had 55 jobs. His daughter has lost insurance at least 3 times over the course of her lifetime. She's paid COBRA once. She's gone bareback twice with no insurance. So I know the difference. And here's what's more typical about America today. Most of us don't have the same job for a decade or 20 years or 30 years. Most of us have to go from one job to the other, which means we have to become familiar with COBRA, which sucks. We have to assume that sometimes we're in job lock because we like our insurance so much we're so afraid of the next job, even though we hate the job, but we like the insurance. Well, that's not why I work. I don't work because I want to go to a doctor. I work because I want to feel fulfilled. I think that what people need to do is explain what people really like. And let's go to unions, Stefan. Unions say, oh, no. I want to be able to negotiate health insurance. I don't want to lose that ability to negotiate. Really? Let me talk to people in unions. You know what they're negotiating? They're giving up salaries in order to stay insured. So they're going to say, okay, we'll only take a 2% raise in our salary so you can eat the increased cost of 20% with my health insurance. You're not sicker by 20%. It's just costing 20% more. So you've sacrificed salary for what? For the possibility that you might get sick and go to a doctor. That sucks. Sorry.
Well, it does. You know, I mean, you can dice and slice health insurance however you want, but the numbers, if they're accurate, and I think Kaiser Permanente is pretty good on numbers,
yep.
and Gallup, I'm
yep.
just looking at a table yep. here of Gallup. I mean, non-white Americans, 62% are generally satisfied with their health insurance, and less than $30,000 a year, 62% of Americans are happy with what they're getting, which either the expectations are terribly low or, you know, they're getting kind of what they expect to get. So
yeah.
then you'd say we're going to do away with this and do something else. You'd better have something that you can sell.
I will.
And you noticed last night in the debate,
it was 10 people. It was 10 people given 13 seconds to say something about a program that you can't describe in 13 seconds. That's part of the problem. So I
sure.
think if I were running for president, okay, and I was running on Medicare for all my ads would be exactly what I just said to you. I would be teaching and teaching and teaching something
yeah.
you can't do in a damn debate, and don't expect it to happen in a debate. But you, what did let me just point this out? Did you see the ads during the debate last night by Donald
yeah.
Trump and his clan? What was it about?
Yeah.
It was about the Supreme Court, and it was about Biden. This is what the ads were. And they were saying, they have a secret list of Supreme Court justices. Tell them to reveal their secret list. Joe Biden, tell them to respect. Now, of course, who has the secret list is actually Donald Trump. Who has actually destroyed the court is actually Donald Trump. But isn't it interesting? The ads they were running during the debate that Donald Trump and his super PACs and, you know, his donors were running were basically insidious and saying they're being clandestine. They're not.
Yeah.
telling you that. So we need to figure out how to fight back. And then the question becomes, what is the message and what is the explainer? Trust me, people don't like insurance. They like their doctor. They don't want to be whacked with a sudden increase in cost. They don't want to be whacked by out-of-network. They don't want to have to call an insurance company about whether they can go to a, you know, a knee doctor. They just want to go to the damn knee doctor. Anyway, that's
all for the moment. Yeah, and on the other hand, why not? I think a lot of Americans would love to hear some of these candidates say, look, we passed the Affordable Health Care Act. Mm-hmm. The Republicans and others hated it. What we have to do is go back to that and
improve it.
Yeah. I mean, why not talk like that? Instead of, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are going to scare off a lot of people because health insurance is the number one in health coverage concern of most Americans.
Okay.
And if you're telling people, remember Obama said, you can keep your doctor, you know, you can keep, you know, your hospital and your provider and stuff like that, even though that wasn't true. But that's what people wanted to hear.
So
they've got to do the narrative a little bit differently.
All right, so you remember what I've been saying over and over again. I've said this to reporters. And what I've said is, I will vote for anything that moves us forward. My goal may be Medicare for all. But if you approve the Affordable Care Act, go for it, honey bun. If you want to have the public option, go for it. All those things are a roadmap for fixing the healthcare system. My goal is I don't want you to negotiate with an insurance company. I don't want an employer to have to spend and hire experts to negotiate with an insurance company. I want people to know that it is a right and that eventually, because you were born here, you can go to a doctor when you're sick. That is a right. That's not a negotiating right. It's not part of a labor contract. It's not part of employment. It's not because you're so poor you have to be on Medicaid or so old you have to be on Medicare. I mean, you tell me, why should someone be privileged at 65 to get something that I at 64 can't get? What makes them better than me? Their age. That's it. That's crap. I mean, this is one issue I get so crazy about. All right.
I know you do, but you have to, you know, we need to improve the system. There's no question. All the candidates agree. But you have to sell it to voters so that you can get the voters who are not unhappy with what they have and would vote Democrat and might not if they're scared to death that, you know, socialism is going to come and Bernie Sanders is going to take a, well, Bernie Sanders is on tonight. We'll see how he does.
You triggered
one of the questions, Arnie, before we move on to something else that you have that I want to make sure we talk about is the biggest question that is on the minds of a lot of people is, will all the Democrats, all 24 or 5, whatever there are this morning, support whoever gets nominated or not? And that question, I think, is nagging at a lot of people. There is a special concern. The news media has been covering this. If you ask Bernie Sanders, if you go to the convention, are you going to challenge the Democrat that might be coming in with almost or enough delegates to get it, the nomination? Are you going to run as an independent or as a Democratic socialist or not? That is a haunting a lot of Democrats.
No.
What
so,
do you think?
So let me just say, if he supported Hillary Clinton, maybe not as passionately as some people wanted him to be.
His supporters, a lot of them voted for Trump.
No, they didn't. That's a lie. Stefan, that is a lie. The fact of the matter is, a lot of them, look, there may have been a couple of million that voted for Jill Stein and not for Hillary Clinton. But let me tell you about the numbers of voters that never showed up and voted at all. The Obama voter that voted for Donald Trump. That voter is far exceeds anything that represented Bernie Sanders. Far exceeded it, and that's on Hillary's plate. That is not Bernie's fault. That is Hillary's fault. Hillary did not keep those Obama voters, in addition to which apathy, 78,000 people that didn't even show up, that's not Bernie. That is Hillary. Put it on Hillary's plate. Stop blaming Bernie.
I have NPR's report, and it says, I don't know if it's correct or not, but it said that, you know, 1 in 10 Bernie Sanders supporters voted for Trump. 12% of voted in 2016 for Donald Trump. And who knows whose fault that is? It doesn't make any difference.
But more important one
Bernie Sanders wasn't enthusiastically supporting Hillary Clinton. He was really grumpy about it.
Well, so the question is, now that we've lived with the misogynist in chief, Now that we've lived with the racist in chief, now that we've lived with the liar in chief, now that we've lived with the Putin puppet in chief, if he was able to hold his nose and support Hillary, if he doesn't passionately, I mean passionately, support whoever the Democrats nominate, a pox on him. Then it's all about his damn ego. Then he wants to trash the country. He wants to deliver for Putin, not even for Trump, but deliver for Putin. If he does that, then I am appalled. And I'm a friend of Bernie Sanders. I've known Bernie Sanders for 30 years. But you know what? There are some things that are more important than him.
Well, maybe I hope so, but you know, you should look at the NPR. Your listeners should look at the NPR report, which says specifically, and I'm quoting, if the Sanders-Trump voters in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania had voted for Clinton, or even if they had stayed home on Election Day, those states would have swung to Clinton, and she would have won 46 more electoral votes, putting her at 278.
So can we just say something?
Those are numbers that come from the national popular vote tracker in 2016. Right. So, you know, Sanders has got to decide if he's a socialist or a Democrat, Arnie.
So here's what I'm so glad you brought up socialist. So there's a guy on MSNBC who – Donnie Deutsch. If Donnie Deutsch says Elizabeth Warren is a socialist one more time, he's getting a knuckle sandwich from me. And the reason he's getting a knuckle sandwich is ask Elizabeth Warren, are you a socialist? She says absolutely not. Mm-hmm. That's her answer. Let me repeat this.
Yeah.
You know what she is? She's actually what most of the Scandinavian countries are, which are actually not socialists. They're compassionate capitalists. That's exactly. And ask Norwegians if they believe in capitalism. They do. Ask Swedes if they believe in capitalism. They do. But they have an incredible safety net. It's not even a safety net. They understand that you make investments in people. You also want to see that businesses succeed. They don't have to be mutually exclusive. And you know what my proof is? IKEA. IKEA is my absolute proof. It's a Swedish company. And at one point in time, the founder of IKEA that every community is killing for, they don't want a Sears Roebuck. They want an IKEA in their community. At one point in time, he was the richest guy on the planet, more than Bill Gates. So you tell me that they don't believe in capitalism, and I'm going to say, really? Do you want an IKEA or do you want a Sears?
Well, then Elizabeth Warren, and I know she will never do this, should say what you just said.
She
should say, I'm a compassionate capitalist.
She
won't say it.
Well,
because she thinks that too many Democratic voters don't like capitalism and are going to punish her for saying that.
But that's why I'm saying the Norwegians call themselves compassionate capitalists.
I know.
They
want to
be like Norway and Finland and Denmark and Sweden. Well, guess what? They do a form of capitalism. They don't not do capitalism. Let me repeat. They do a form of capitalism. It's just that their capitalism doesn't genuflect to the 1% and give it to the rich and screw everyone else. I like that kind of capitalism. So do American people. So do a lot of voters, including those ones that think that they want socialism. Actually, what they want is they want compassionate capitalism. That's what they want. Pure socialism doesn't make sense. Pure communism doesn't make sense. Pure capitalism doesn't make sense. What makes sense is something that actually is a little more filtered, a little more nuanced, and understands you want companies to survive. But if they survive at the expense of everybody else, then it's not an economy you can support.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that was, of course, the objective of progressive income taxes. It was the objective of creating all of the agencies.
I mean,
you know how many agencies we have in Washington that are there to provide elderly people, that provide money for food stamps?
And how many agencies provide, you know, rebates for wealthy corporations, too? Don't even get me started.
Sure,
anyway,
but the purpose of creating those agencies was to soften the impact of pure competitive capital or non-competitive capitalism.
And I need capitalism. To let you go. Stefan Schmidt.
And those agencies have to be strengthened and not weakened or even done away with.
Stefan
Schmidt
is known affectionately
now
as Dr. Politics. He joins us every Thursday. I can't wait to talk after tonight's debate. Ciao. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, everyone. A Little Think by Aretha Franklin.
Let yourself be free. Let's go back. mountains.
Listening to WNHN LP 94.7 FM, Concord, New Hampshire.